All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've got a packed show today, so let's just jump right into it. At the back end of the show, we're going to be hearing an interview I did with the family of Keisha Michael, 31 years old, who was murdered by police in Inglewood, California, along with her friend Marquinton Sandlin, 32 years old, on February 21st, while they were sleeping. That's right, sleeping. They were unconscious in a car parked on a public street. Now we're going to listen to an interview I did last year with Raymond Lada, a writer for Revolution newspaper, on the U.S. normalization of relations with Cuba. And this has become even more relevant today because of the recent visit by President Obama to Cuba. On December 17th, the United States and Cuba announced the restoration of full diplomatic relations. President Obama also announced that the U.S. will ease restrictions on travel, on the amount of cash that can be sent to individuals in Cuba, and on the export of telecommunications equipment and on certain banking activity. This is the beginning of an article by Raymond Lada. Raymond's a writer for Revolution newspaper and an advocate of the work of Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And this article is something that really digs into just what the hell is going on with this situation in Cuba. And Raymond's joining us to talk about it today. Raymond, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on, Michael. It's a very important question at this time to be getting into.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's jump into it. The title of your article is "The Recolonization in the Name of Normalization: Behind the Reestablishment of U.S.-Cuba Diplomatic Relations." What's your overall take on this? I mean, you talk about recolonization in the name of normalization. What are you talking about here?
Yeah. Well, the basic thesis of the article is that there is obviously a big shift in the U.S. imperialist stance towards Cuba. And this is taking the form of the full restoration of diplomatic relations, along with some of the economic relations that are being opened up that you mentioned in setting up the interview here. Now, what I'm arguing is that the terms of normalization are not in the interests of the Cuban people. I'm basically making two points about this in terms of an overview. One, that the U.S. has no right, has had no right, and has no right to economically punish and diplomatically isolate Cuba, and all of what it's done in terms of military threats, invasions, assassination attempts, all of what it's done, you know, since the Cuban Revolution in 1959. This is completely unjust, unacceptable, and immoral. So that, on the one hand. On the other, the terms of normalization that are being dictated by the United States are terms that are really aimed at two things. One, opening Cuba up to exploitation by U.S. capital, and two, it's a strategic move by U.S. imperialism as part of a larger calculation to reassert its influence, its strength, and its hegemony in the Western Hemisphere. So that's essentially what I'm saying here, that the U.S. has had no right and has no right to diplomatically and economically isolate and punish Cuba. But this normalization is not what it's being heralded as in the media here, and even by, you know, some leftists and progressives, which is that somehow Obama has made a bold and brave break with past policy, and this represents something that's very good for the Cuban people. No, this is something that is driven by U.S. strategic and economic interest. Mm-hmm. That's the basic argument, the basic point that I'm making and that I unfold in the article.
And we'll get into that in just a little bit. But I wanted you to go back a minute to this point about what the U.S. relationship with Cuba has been, including in the very beginning. Because, you know, as I was reading your piece, I kept thinking, you know, the vast majority of the people alive in this country anyway, and maybe in the world, don't have any idea about what the history of the relationship between U.S. and Cuba is or has been. So can you dig into that? Because you present a very compelling and disgusting picture as well about what actually that relationship had been before the Cuban Revolution.
Yeah. For more than 100 years, the United States has imposed incredible suffering and misery on the Cuban people. I mean, let's step back. Historically, in the 19th century, the late 19th century, the Cuban people rose up in a national independent struggle. Cuba had been a colony of Spain. And in the late 1800s, as I said, there was this fierce liberation struggle, a rebellion against Spanish colonial rule. And in 1898, the U.S. moved to take advantage of this struggle. And there was what was called the Spanish-American War. The U.S. imperialists saw an opening, an opportunity to maneuver, to take advantage of this independence struggle to bring Cuba under its wing and under its control. And this is what the United States did. There was the famous explosion that took place on the battleship Maine in Havana Harbor, and this has now been shown to have been a planned explosion as a pretext to get the U.S. population all fired up and whipped up to support U.S. military activity in Cuba. And in 1898, the U.S. was able to impose terms on the Spaniards, you know, who were, as I said, being assaulted by the Cuban people in their battle for independence. And the U.S. was able to maneuver to bring Cuba under its control, taking advantage, as I said, of that independence struggle. And what it did is it imposed, through treaty arrangements, ways and means by which it would dictate its power over the Cuban economy and Cuban society. One of the key elements of this was what was called the Platt Amendment. Your listeners may not have heard of that, P-L-A-T-T. This was an amendment that was passed by the U.S. Congress, and it gave the U.S. the right to interfere in the affairs, the internal affairs of Cuba. And this was actually incorporated in the new Cuban Constitution. And as a result of this, the U.S. landed Marines in Cuba four times in the early 1900s. And also established its military colony, Guantanamo, the Guantanamo naval base, which is now, as we know, a Guantanamo torture and concentration camp serving the interest of U.S. imperialism. So the U.S. was able to impose indirect control over Cuba through these treaty provisions, through its economic penetration and economic and political power. And in the 1898 Spanish-American War, and the outcome of that, U.S. directly annexed Puerto Rico, the Philippines, Hawaii, and Guam. In the case of Cuba, it was formally independent, but as I said, the U.S. was running the show economically, politically, and militarily, and it gave backing and support, financial and military, to a whole string of corrupt dictators that were operating and serving in the interests of U.S. imperialism. One of the things I do in the article is I give some data, kind of a thumbnail sketch of the extent to which the U.S. controlled this economy. 80% of the utilities, 90% of the mines, nickel mining in Cuba, 100% of the oil refineries, 90% of the cattle ranches, and 40% of sugar production was controlled by U.S. capital. And for sugar plantation workers, by the way, I had been to Cuba in 1970. I spoke with, you know, older workers at the time. I was very young, but I spoke with some of the older Cuban sugar workers, and they told me what it was like working in the fields, the cruel and oppressive conditions of exploitation, punctuated by periods of unemployment, what they call dead time, tiempo muerte. This was what it was like. And at the same time, Cuba was turned into this den for gambling, for prostitution, real estate speculation. People may have seen The Godfather, the movie with Marlon Brando, and the second installment of The Godfather has coverage. Part of the storyline takes you to Cuba in the 1950s, where the mobster Meyer Lansky had huge investments in hotels. This is what Cuba was like. It was controlled and dominated by the U.S. There were, and this is pretty remarkable for a country of perhaps 9 million people at the time, there were 60,000 to 100,000 prostitutes in Cuba. This was a sex tourism center for U.S. businessmen and travelers. This was the backdrop for the Cuban Revolution of 1959. This was the Cuba that has been extolled and lauded as the society that had been lost to these communist infidels. But this was the reality of Cuban society on the eve of the Cuban Revolution in 1959. And this is the backdrop from the Spanish-American War, the Cuban battle for independence, how the U.S. moved to take advantage of that and was able to thoroughly dominate every facet of Cuban society.
Now, Raymond, one of the things, as you're saying, and I keep thinking too, there was also something else that actually really stood out to me because I was watching a Boardwalk Empire, for instance, again, the repetition of sort of what Cuba was. There were all the bootleggers going down there and all the casinos and all this other stuff. But there was also that the U.S. didn't just do that, but they also propped up a very brutal dictator by the name of Batista during that time as well, right?
Yeah. In this period of the 1950s, now Boardwalk Empire is taking place much earlier. We can go by our gangster films and gangster TV series.
Yeah.
Boardwalk Empire is taking place, right, you know, in the early phase of U.S. domination over Cuba. And, you know, we're talking about the late teens and the 20s, the 1920s into the early 30s. Batista was the ruler who was in power in the 1950s, and he received military backing and economic assistance from the U.S. He himself was heavily invested in some of these gambling operations and also had large land holdings himself. And he was notorious, not just for his corruption, but for his brutality. You know, there was a prison. This is where Castro and other political figures were sent. There was an island where people were sent. It was kind of like a Devil's Island prison. It was an incredibly repressive society. So you had, you know, all this foreign capital, U.S. capital, that was dominating. You had this casino economy, and you had this brutal exploitation of sugar plantation workers. And, you know, United Fruit owned land in Cuba. This was the notorious U.S. agribusiness firm that dominated lots of agricultural production in the Caribbean and Central America. And then you had this character, Batista, you know, with his armed forces that was imposing this tight-fisted, ironclad rule to prevent the Cuban people from asserting, you know, their rights and their ability to actually take control of society.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We're talking today with Raymond Lada. Raymond's a political economist, a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and an advocate of Bob Avakian's new synthesis of communism. Well, let's move on with this, because I think that's, you know, it's also very important in terms of understanding all that. It's also very important as a basis for understanding, as you said, this is sort of was the backdrop and the grounding for what emerged as the Cuban Revolution in 1959 and the 1950s. So let's talk about that a little bit. What was that, and what was the response of the U.S. to that?
Well, the Cuban Revolution was led by Fidel Castro, as people know, and it was a movement that had an urban base, and it was a movement that is among intellectuals and progressive professional forces. It had a base among workers, the tobacco workers and sugar workers, and it was a revolution that saw this guerrilla movement in the mountains and in the countryside gather strength and influence. And there was a movement, as I said, corresponding to this in the cities. And in 1959, this revolution led by Castro was able to topple the hated Batista regime, the regime that we were just talking about. And this was a mass uprising. It was a just, it was a popular uprising that overthrew this regime of Batista and also began to move against the vested U.S. economic interests. Shortly after coming to power, there were attempts to negotiate some agreements with the United States, but the U.S. took a very strong position that it was not going to allow its paradise, you know, to slip out of its hands. And Castro led in nationalizing the holdings of many of the U.S. firms, and then began to carry out social programs, literacy and health. So this was what was taking place in the early years of the Cuban Revolution. As I said, it was a mass uprising, and it moved to nationalize, that is, to assert state control over these economic holdings, and it launched certain social programs. But what I go on to emphasize in this article is that Cuba, under Fidel Castro's leadership and this leadership core of the revolution, did not carry out a genuine all-around revolution, that is, a socialist revolution. On the one hand, it did not break the vice grip, the stranglehold of imperialism, of world capitalism, the world capitalist market over the Cuban economy. That is, the Cuban economy was organized around sugar. It was organized around the dominance of a single imperialist power, the United States. 70% of Cuba's trade was with the United States. Sugar was king. all aspects of the economy were subordinate to this, what's called a monoculture, that agriculture was structured around sugar, and the larger economy was structured around the export of sugar. Now, I did mention there were investments in other fields and spheres. There was the gambling, and there was the hotel, there was the real estate, you know, that very parasitic component of the Cuban economy. But at the root and at the core of this economy was sugar. Now, Fidel Castro led this uprising, but as I said, he did not carry this forward to carry out a break with this situation in which sugar was the linchpin, the king of the economy, if you will. And whereas before, the U.S. was the dominant economic power, and sugar was being sold to the United States, and this was how the economy was structured, Castro was looking for a quick fix. Rather than carrying out an all-around economic transformation to break that dependency on the world market, to diversify agriculture, to make it possible for Cuba to meet its own food needs, Castro elected go with sugar. And instead of the U.S. now being the main recipient of sugar and its main customer, Castro looked to the Soviet Union, which called itself socialist but was not socialist. In the mid-1950s, capitalism was restored in the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union became a social imperialist power, of an imperial power that had a socialist cover. And Castro looked to the Soviet Union to play this kind of, if I might use the phrase, sugar daddy role, that is, to purchase sugar. And with the revenues from that sugar, Castro was able to pump funds into certain social programs. They also received from the Soviet Union oil at low prices, which they then resold on the world market. And this was the arrangement, the economic arrangement that Castro entered into. And as I said, it didn't fundamentally and radically alter the dependency of the Cuban economy and Cuban society on the world market. It was still beholden to sugar, and everything was structured around sugar, around more sugar production. Produce, raise the amount of tonnage that could be yielded in any year. And this was the logic that Castro enacted from the standpoint of, well, we're going to use those revenues to transform society. No, it didn't transform society, nor did the revolutionary leadership, as he described themselves, as the leaders described themselves, did they launch a social revolution. In other words, there was not the economic restructuring in terms of agriculture and creating a self-reliant, sustainable agriculture that could feed the people and carry out a step-by-step program of developing industry that could serve that kind of diverse and integrated agriculture, nor was there a genuine social revolution that was aimed at really digging up the oppressive relations, patriarchy, the profound inequalities between men and women. These things did not happen, battling racism. This was not a genuine revolution on the social front either. So the critique in the article, and this is the critique that Mao and the Chinese revolutionaries were making of Cuba, was that they were not breaking the grip of imperialism on the one hand, nor are they launching a genuine social revolution on the other. They were looking for a quick fix. So rather than the United States being the key market and the key source of credit and subsidies, now the Soviet Union, which was no longer socialist, took that place and played that role. Even with this, Cuba remained a thorn in the side of U.S. imperialism.
That's exactly where I wanted to go, actually, because that was the point, too, is that, you know, I was thinking that as you're talking about, even with all that, and maybe in some ways, even because of its linking up with the Soviet Union, this whole point of there was just an endless series of attempts to overthrow Castro, to poison him, to kill him, the Bay of Pigs invasion, and the whole, like, armada of nukes that were just pointed at Cuba in the 1960s. You know, let's talk about that a little bit. And then that also raises a question as, well, what the hell has happened? What's changed now that suddenly the U.S. can make this sort of new approach to Cuba?
Well, so now we're moving the story forward. We began with the period of Spanish rule, and then the U.S. moves in. Then in 1959, the Cuban Revolution takes place, and Cuba becomes integrated into the Soviet imperial bloc. And now most of its trade is conducted with the Soviet Union and with Eastern Europe. And as I said, even though this was not a radical transformation of society, of economic relations, of the culture, it was still an obstacle to U.S. plans in the Western Hemisphere and internationally. Castro remained a vocal critic of U.S. imperialism. He gave support to anti-imperialist movements in the Western Hemisphere, and he did not buckle under to U.S. threats and pressures to sort of hang it up and to sort of surrender to U.S. imperialism. So the U.S. was not reconciled to its defeat, you know, by the Cuban Revolution, to its lost paradise being taken over, and never relented in its efforts to undermine this revolution. And you yourself, as you asked the question, indicated some of the things. There was the Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961. This was a CIA-financed, backed, and orchestrated invasion of Cuba by Cuban exiles in 1961. And the purpose of this was to overthrow Castro and to install a government that would be friendly and supine to the United States. Well, that invasion was defeated by the Cuban people. There were the assassination attempts, and the U.S. employed, you know, we keep coming back to the mobsters and the mafia and the gangsters, and made use of gangsters and mafia to carry out assassination attempts. And there was the imposition of this embargo. And the embargo is a term. It means preventing Cuba. This was imposed by the United States. It was imposed by the United States and enforced by the U.S. Navy, and this was to prevent trade between Cuba and other countries. The U.S. cut off economic relations, and it put pressure on Latin American countries to cease carrying out trade, and also put pressure on the West European countries. This was in the 1960s and 1970s through the 1980s. So these were the ways, militarily, through attempts at assassination, through sabotage, through terrorist acts, and through economic pressure, that the U.S. was constantly working to undermine this regime and to topple it.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We're talking today with Raymond Latta. Raymond's a political economist, a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and an advocate of Bob Avakian's new synthesis of communism. So what is it that's changed? This is a big question for people.
When we carry this history forward, as I mentioned, Cuba did not carry out an all-around revolution. And as a result, it was not a radical transformation of the economy. It wasn't a radical transformation of social relations. And Cuba became ever more dependent on the Soviet Union for subsidies, for support. And in exchange for that, as I said, Cuba was able to import food by selling oil that it got from the Soviet Union on the world market. It was able to sell its sugar to the Soviet Union at subsidized prices. So this was the arrangement. But the Soviet Union collapsed in 1989, and this set off tremors in the Cuban economy precisely because it was so beholden to those commercial and economic arrangements. So the gross domestic product, you know, just plummeted by 35% in the early 90s. It wasn't able to import goods anymore in the same way that it had before. And Cuba entered into an extended period of economic crisis. So the Cuban leadership, again, applying that outlook of looking for quick fixes, no longer had the Soviet Union as the source of credit, as the source of economic assistance, as the market that would be reliable for it. So what you have is another attempt at a quick fix. And here, the Cuban leadership looks to moving away from sugar towards tourism. And it invites in foreign investment. And we see foreign investors coming into certain spheres of Cuba. And then with tourism growing and the hotel industry growing, and I'm talking about in the mid and late 1990s, you begin to see the reappearance of social evils like prostitution. So this is what's happening. But the economy is entering into this very, very serious crisis. And Cuba now doesn't have the Soviet Union, but it looks in the early 2000s to the Venezuela. Venezuela is providing it with oil at discounted prices, and with that oil, it's able to continue to function economically. And Cuba is offsetting the discounted price of oil with credits that it's obtaining from China and other capitalist and imperialist countries. And Cuba is also sending doctors to Venezuela. This is the arrangement. But now Venezuela is entering into crisis with the collapse of world oil prices. And this is putting additional pressure, new sources of pressure on Cuba. So the backdrop for this move by the United States is twofold. One, the Cuban economy is in serious crisis, and the leadership in Cuba is looking to wheel and deal now with the United States. And the leadership is also looking to hold on, so it wants to stabilize. And this is one means and measure by which it can do it. Then there's the question of what the U.S. is motivated by, why the U.S. is undertaking this shift in its stance and its posture towards Cuba. And this, as I said, is not driven by some newfound respect for the sovereignty of Cuba or Obama suddenly waking up and saying, aha, we have to treat them as equals and that our old policies didn't work. They say their old policies didn't work, but what they are actually doing is implementing a new set of policies which are aimed at achieving regime change, but this time the regime change is from within. That is, by penetrating Cuba economically, politically, socially, through the media, through the internet, through the hotel industry once anew, and putting pressure from within. This is what is economically motivating and politically motivating the U.S., and I also bring into the picture a larger geostrategic component. And this is very critical, Michael. And by that, I'm referring to the fact that since the early 2000s, the U.S. has been focused in its war for greater empire, its war on the world that goes by the name of the war on terrorism. And the focus of those efforts have militarily been in the Middle East and in Central Asia. And that's been the focus of U.S. foreign policy. And it was not paying, the U.S. imperialists were not paying as much attention to Latin America. And in this period of the 2000s into the new decade that we're in, China was very quietly and very steadily increasing its influence in the Western Hemisphere, in South America, in Latin America. China has emerged as the second largest foreign investor in South America. It is the largest trading partner of Brazil, which is the largest economy in Latin America. So China has been emerging as an economic rival to the United States in its own hemisphere, the Western Hemisphere. And it regards Latin America, the U.S. does, arrogantly as its backyard. And here China is gaining strength. And you have Venezuela asserting its foreign policy in the 2000s, which was another thorn in the side of U.S. imperialism. So this geopolitical situation is of concern to U.S. imperialism, the growing economic strength of China, and a lot of China's investments are focused in raw materials and in what's called infrastructure, building roads and dams, and it is constructing a new canal. It's now entered into agreement with Nicaragua to construct a canal that will be longer and deeper than the Panama Canal. So this is what's driving U.S. imperialism to look at its relationship with Cuba in a different way. That is, to enter into these more normalized relations in order to achieve regime change from within, as I say, and to integrate Cuba into its imperial network as a way of reasserting its influence and hegemony, that is, its dominant position in the Western Hemisphere.
All right. Now, Raymond, we have about 5 minutes, but I really don't want to leave without speaking to the point that you made in your piece about actually what Cuba needs is a real revolution. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I'm saying is I've painted a picture of Cuba as a society that was not able, under the leadership of Castro, under that leadership, to affect the kind of revolution that is needed in Cuba and in today's world. And what I'm drawing on in this analysis is what Bob Avakian has described as three alternative worlds. And people can look at that article at revcom.us. And I think it's very helpful, this essay by Avakian, Three Alternative Worlds, to sort out and understand what are the challenges before us today. The first alternative, he says, is to leave the world the way it is, with all its wars for empire, the destruction of the environment, the brutalization and degradation of women. That is not acceptable. We don't want to live in this kind of world. The second alternative is to put some band-aids on certain economic and social inequities. This is what happened in Cuba, and it's really just a variation on leaving the world as it is. What the world needs is a truly emancipatory alternative, a genuine communist revolution, what Marx called the two radical ruptures, to rupture with traditional property relations, with all forms of exploitation, and with traditional ideas, with all that enslaves and imprisons people, all oppression. And this is the revolution that is needed to uproot all exploitation, to overcome all oppressive relations, the deep-seated inequalities between men and women, the fact that there is a profound divide between mental and manual labor, between those who labor with their hands and those who are able to work in the realm of ideas, to be able to empower the masses of people to make decisions over the basic direction of society, to have a society in which intellectual life, intellectual ferment and dissent are not only tolerated but are welcomed and fostered. This is the kind of society where people are being empowered. The vast majority are being empowered to ever more consciously change themselves and change society in the interest of emancipating humanity. This is the revolution that's needed, and it is a monumental challenge. It is complex to make this kind of revolution in today's world, and it requires visionary vanguard leadership basing itself on a scientific understanding of reality and how society and the world can be transformed. But this is possible, and this is what Avakian has brought forward, a framework, an understanding, a strategy to do this, because there are these challenges. There's the globalization of the world economy, the environmental crisis, and the threats of imperialist intervention, attack, and encirclement when revolution does break through. But this is possible. This revolution is what's needed. It is viable, and it is the only alternative to the badness and horror of today's world.
Raymond Lada, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me on the show, and hopefully we can talk more about this and other issues.
Absolutely, man. Look forward to it. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Raymond Lada, political economist and writer for Revolution Newspaper, and we've been talking about the U.S. and Cuba, and specifically about Raymond's piece, Recolonization in the Name of Normalization, Behind the Reestablishment of U.S.-Cuba Diplomatic Relations. You can find this article on the site revcom.us, and you can also find a lot of other things on there that would really help you understand the world and get involved in changing the world. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Jasiri X with Don't Let Them Get Away with Murder. Now we're going to be hearing the interview I did with members of Keisha Michaels' family. On Sunday, February 21st, at about 3 a.m. in the morning, Inglewood, California police shot and killed Keisha Michael and Marquinton Sandlin. And actually, you might as well say Inglewood, California police shot and murdered. It wasn't like they just killed. They murdered Keisha Michael and Marquinton Sandlin. And here to talk with us about this heinous crime are members of Keisha's family. All right, so we'll go around the room. First, there's David, and you're Keisha's dad?
Yes.
Okay, Rose, and you're Keisha's mom?
Yes.
Gregory, you're Keisha's cousin?
Yes.
And Tricia, you're Keisha's twin sister?
Yes.
Okay. people woke up Sunday morning and you found out that your daughter was dead and that it's something that happened, and people heard about this and they heard one story from the police, which was, it just painted it as, well, it was a normal thing that happens. It was sort of like there was a car parked there and there were these two people sitting in there and they were sound. They didn't even say they were asleep first. What they said was the woman had a gun. Mm-hmm. We tried to get in there and change the situation to actually deal with it in a good way, but then we had to back up and then suddenly we had to open fire on them. And then it was just passed down as that this is another one of these things that happened. I want you guys to tell people the truth about what happened. Whichever one of you wants to start first is fine with me. Rose?
Well, what I know so far, it happened Sunday morning. I did not know that until they came to my door Sunday evening, almost around 5 p.m., and told me that Keisha was dead. Dead where? They said she was found in the car. I said, what time? He said around 4 a.m. that morning. And so I said, no, it couldn't be Keisha. Which car? Because Keisha had a car. She was driving my car, a Honda. And then they told me it was a
Malibu.
Yeah, black Malibu. Chevy Malibu or something like that. I said, it was a shock to me. So I waited and I said, and I asked, so who was in the car with her? Was there anybody else in the car? They said, yes. So was the person killed also? Was the person dead? They said, yes. That's what they told me. They were found dead in the car. That's all I know. And I couldn't ask any more questions because they told me that they were investigating. And so far, it's been a while now. It's almost a month, I would think. And we haven't heard anything yet. So still waiting. I'm still waiting.
Tricia.
So just a little recap of what my mom just said. It's them saying they found her body in the car when the whole time they knew that they was a part of the situation and not stating that they had something to do with it. It's still like some type of like a hiccup on their part, but at the same time, like, seeing it on the news after the fact, just waking up that morning and looking at the news, I would not think that that was my sister, because I guess they couldn't put their name out there until they notified the family. So when the family was notified, then looking at that, I was like, oh my goodness, everybody's seen this, but nobody knew. We wouldn't have thought it was her. It's just, I'm just hurt. I'm outraged. I'm grieving in the hardest way ever for that to be my twin, my sister, and just seeing her, like, she was overkilled. She was shot about 7 times. She was shot in the face. My sister was overkilled. Like, there's still no reason, and just looking at her, and I'm just looking at her, and how tight and so how close shut her eyes was. It's like, I felt it, like she's unaware of what happened to her. She don't even know what hit her. To me, she looks was like she was asleep the whole time. She don't even know what hit her. She couldn't duck. She couldn't hide. She couldn't run if she wanted to. She didn't know what happened to her. They died in their sleep. And I feel that in my heart. And I see that in her face. She was just overkilled. I was just so overwhelmed. I couldn't sleep all night. I was crying all night. My face is swollen. I don't know what to do. Like, her kids, just looking at her kids, a mother of three. A single mother out here trying in the world, just having fun for one night, and ended up dead. And we still don't know why. I don't know. I mean, I'm hurt. I don't know what to do sometimes, you know. I have these outbursts and, you know, trying to be calm about the situation. You know, I don't want to be hatred to the police and none of that situation. But at the same time, I still need answers. This is why we out here protesting. I started an organization on behalf of Keisha Michael, the Keisha Michael Foundation, and just to bring awareness about this situation. I don't even know how to explain what this is. It's just assassination. Like, who does that to civilians with a machine gun? She was brutally killed with a machine gun.
Let's talk about this a little. What you heard when the officials talked to you at first, they said she was found dead.
Yes. In a car.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And you think about that, because what it leaves you open to is exactly what you thought. Well, what happened? Did she have a heart attack? Did she, you know, have an accident? Did she, you know, somebody come up and do something to her? Or you think about also what they said after that is they said that, well, they came up and the first story they told, right, besides what they said to you, which didn't get out in the news in that kind of way, that she was just found dead. But what mm-hmm. they said was that they came up and the woman had a gun. We tried to talk them down. We had to retreat. And then we had to open fire. So they painted a picture of your daughter, Rose, being someone who was like sort of a little crazy at the time and had a gun and was threatening the police. That was the story that they put out to the public, basically, right?
Well, if that's the story they put out, why didn't they tell me that story?
Yeah.
So I don't know how the media got it, and I didn't get the story.
Mm-hmm.
And if you listen to what the mayor said, you listen to it and you see what he said. He said they were unconscious.
These lies just keep building one on top of the other, right?
Right.
I mean, that's what's going on. You know? So, did you want to say something, David?
I want to say that it's really hurt me because what happened, I was on a trip coming down from Vegas when my daughter called me and telling me, Dad, my sister died. I said, what? But I couldn't understand her because she in her cryingness and thing. When I called her mom, I said, Fisher called me just now and said, Keisha died. Is that true? And she said, yes. I said, what? From that time, I feel my whole chest like one bus open because I said, it can't be true. Because just like either a week or 2 weeks ago, me, Trisha, and the kids were at my place and we were talking a lot of things. She was talking like, Daddy, I want to go back to Vegas and settle down with my kids and try to settle her life together with her children. And that's the last time I remember I see Keisha when all of us were together.
Gregory, did you want to say something?
I saw the news like 7 o'clock in the morning. I usually get up around that time. I turn on the TV and it sounded like strange to me when I heard the news. I even knew it was my cousin. But the way the news reporter reported the news was like they found a woman with a gun and they had to engage the woman. And there's a guy that was in the hospital that they couldn't tell if he was related with the woman, if the shooting was related, so the police wasn't giving the story if the shooting was related with the guy in the hospital and the woman on the ground, right? So I say, that doesn't sound good. How there could be an officer involved shooting and they can't tell if the two person is related with the same shooting? So I said to myself, that sound funny. They're not telling the whole story or something like that. Then I get a call like in the evening and they told me, you hear about your cousin? I said, really? I said, no. I said, oh, that's the news I heard early in the morning. I said, oh, that sounds funny from where I heard it. I said, that story sounds funny. And I said to myself, there's more to meet the eye than this story. Mm-hmm. And since then, I just waiting for the police to give for their version of the story, and I'm still waiting to the day.
Well, the problem is we're getting a lot of versions of the story.
It's too much versions.
Go ahead.
It's every channel in a different story. We just need the police to come out and just give their statement. And we're waiting on that day.
Let me ask you this, Trisha, because you made a point earlier, and it's like they gave that one statement that we were just talking about, when the initial thing about, you know, which was very quickly, anybody who looked at it, one, had the kinds of questions you guys were saying you have, but then two, it became clear that it was a lie.
Yeah.
And then they gave a second statement, which was that they had to shoot.
The story I heard was the woman had a gun, they took position, and they started shooting. But they didn't say what made them shoot. Then all of a sudden, later on, it's a different version. Somebody waved a gun. Somebody pointed a gun.
One of the ways this lie came out was they said they had to de-escalate the situation.
Right.
What did you think?
How do you de-escalate a situation for two unconscious people?
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. How are you threatened by two unconscious people? I don't understand that. This is outrageous. Like, even the mayor said it. They were unconscious, and then he wanted to retract what he said and said for some reason they might have been conscious for them to feel threatened. How do two people that you wake up, how do you feel threatened by waking up two people? Police have procedures. You stand off, you hold on a situation, not for 45 minutes, not for an hour, but you stand off and you hold out and wait to see if they could get out the car, to see if they can put the gun down, to put their hands up, to get out the car. You know what I'm saying? Something.
De-escalate the situation.
To de-escalate the situation. But it wasn't no de-escalating with two unconscious people. How? How do you do that?
That's exactly what I thought, especially when they were talking about that, when they said they were asleep. Yes, and then we had to de-escalate the situation. What are you talking about? To de-escalate from sleeping?
Right.
Right. And it's just one lie after that. And I want to talk a little bit about what the mayor actually said, because people got to be clear about this. This mayor, when he said this, and I think it was important what you're saying, Trisha, the point that he said of, well, somebody must have woken up.
Threatened.
Yeah.
How do you feel threatened?
Yeah. And that's exactly the point. But he backed up and he had to say that. It was like he was just like a stumbling, mumbling fool at that point. But he's telling this lie that goes out to the world.
Yes. You know?
And that was just, I mean, I was looked at again this morning. I was just like, this is absolutely outrageous. It's lie after lie after lie.
As far as I am looking at the whole situation is that I still wait for here is like just gossiping. It's like just leak information that I'm hearing. I'm trying to hear the official police release or statement. I think I still haven't heard
and
that.
And how does the media get all this information? How do they know that this woman had a gun? How are you so for sure that this woman had a gun? How do you not know that this gun wasn't put in her lap or put under the seat or in her hands? My sister never owned a gun. She've never in her life owned a gun. A single mother of three working, trying to survive life. She wouldn't own a gun. She wouldn't risk her life. She had plenty of chance to risk her life before her kids. She better be in jail than dead. And that's for sure. If that's the point they trying to make. But she wouldn't even stoop to that level to kill herself, to point a gun at a police officer, to even just go out dying. Like she was some type of set it off kind of female.
Yeah.
Like she just came and robbed somebody. Like she just went and killed somebody. Like, you know, I don't understand. This is ridiculous.
And you know, you think about it. And if that was actually true, if it was actually true that she pointed a gun at a cop and they felt they had to shoot, wouldn't that be what they told people in the beginning?
Right.
That's right. Yeah.
Right.
Instead of all this mumbling and lying.
When something like this happens, don't they show the evidence? Don't they like, oh, this is what they did and this is what we got? Don't they do that?
They do. They have a procedure, right, that they follow after a shooting.
Like,
that's
she
why,
did this,
that's
and found. Here it is. This is what she did. Like, you know, it's they dramatic with it. They show you the evidence. They show you everything. We can't even see the car. We can't even get her property. We barely could have got her body out the coroner office. It took us forever to do that. We just arranging her funeral. She's not even laid to rest. I'm not rested until she's rested. And I'm going to have her voice until as long as I live. She was only 31 years old. A single mother of three boys. Her youngest is 3 years old. And today, up to today, he thinking his mom is going to walk through that door. He don't know. The other two oldest ones have an understanding, but they not feeling it yet.
Yeah.
It's for me being her twin sister and just seeing me is why they're even getting through life.
There's one more lie I want to dig into, too, which is at first, what they said to people, as we're saying, what they said was what they told you, Rose, and what they then put out in the press. And then as it's like started to get revealed more and more. And you know, the only reason the mayor actually said what he said is because stuff was coming out.
It was
pressure. Right.
Yeah.
Well, it was going to get revealed.
Yeah.
But the thing is, Tricia, you mentioned something earlier, and you said she was killed with a machine gun. Now, one of the things, I read a report that said that what they did when they backed away from the car, they make it seem it was like two cops in their patrol car just sitting there and like waiting. But they actually called in SWAT.
Yes.
And they had high-powered weapons. Tell me a little bit about that. What did they do?
Well, from my understanding, I don't really know what they did because we don't have the official police report. But from my understanding and the videotape that's on Facebook and different witnesses that's been coming out since I've been out there, and I've been out there every day. I was out there last night. They got her from the blind side, from the back. The way she was shot was all coming from the back portion of her. She didn't know what hit her. She didn't know what the hell was coming to her. They assassinated them. And I don't know why.
It's not only from the back, and from the side, too.
And from the side. All upper shots. She got hit in the face.
You said a machine gun.
Yes.
That's actually, how did you find that out?
Have we seen in the news clipping, in the news reel? And you see some SWATs with some big rifle and stuff.
From the Facebook thing.
And then there was some bullets on the ground, so you can know it's from a machine gun.
Yeah.
The size of the bullets, like a M16 or something like that.
Hmm. And that's on Facebook. Everything we're talking about is on Facebook. If anybody want to go and check out and see the video, listen to the audio. It's on Facebook.
So the last statement that the cops have made was the one they made through the mayor?
Right.
That's the last official statement.
That's the last official statement is when the mayor.
And that's not even official. That is coming from the mayor.
Right. That's not official.
That's not official. There's nothing official as far as we know.
Although it's interesting, the mayor's an ex-cop.
Cop. Yes. Yeah, ex-chief too, right? Ex-chief.
For him to say that and not really know the facts, but for him to, he had knowledge, obviously, about the situation. And somebody was pressing him. I don't know where he was, but it looked like he wasn't even in the right place to sit down to speak to the media was moving around, and they asked him this question, and he had something to say about it. So he has some type of knowledge about the situation. Mm-hmm. For him to even say that. Yeah, when they approached, they was unconscious. You all know that they was unconscious. Everybody know they was unconscious. How do two unconscious people end up dead? And if she had a gun, why is Marquinton Sanders dead? How does that happen?
Yeah.
How does one person have a gun and the person other person is dead as well? How does that work? I don't know what they felt or how they felt threatened until we get the official report, but they felt some type of way about these people. My sister and Marquinton Sanders. Keisha Michael, they felt some type of way for them to kill them like that. I don't understand why.
There's certain things that we can't reveal right now that's we think we're going to have like legal consequences, but certain things that we can't reveal that we know that the work that they've been doing was so sloppy, real sloppy, even from the initial incident that happened till after the whole investigation. We've got evidence that we know that it's so sloppy that and we can't even reveal it right now because we know we're going to have legal courses that we have to follow mm-hmm. behind it.
Now, let me ask you something. It's something that nobody ever gets a chance to do. And when, especially when you're dealing with the newspapers and the press of the people that run this country and run all the stuff who are linked up with the police and everything we've been saying. You notice what the press says generally is the police story. You never hear the people's story. We're hearing that now. But I also want people to know something because whenever I talk to people about their loved ones who've been killed by the police, we can't have them just be thin paper people. You know, I want people to know what Keisha was like. I want them to know about her.
She went through a lot of struggles, you know, as far as having her babies and getting married. And she got married but wasn't able to be in the right marriage. So she went through a lot of struggle in her life, being a single mom, raising her kids on her own. And going through them struggles on her own, but also was so happy. She was so hurt. She was struggling, but still smiling, always smiling. Always smiling, no matter what she was going through. Dropping her kids off here at this person's house so they could watch her son so she could go to work. She was cleaning houses. She was cleaning mansions. The Prince of Sarabia mansion out here in Beverly Hills. She was cleaning their mansion. She left L.A. cleaning houses, making good money to go to Vegas to be in a different environment for her kids. In Vegas, she was working at KFC. Her by herself, no family members, got her apartment, her three kids by herself, found friends, found people that is able to help her in different type of ways. But she always struggled, always hurting, always in some type of deep debt, but still smiling. Because her family always had her back. She was just a loving mother, a struggling mother, a kind-hearted mother. And you couldn't tell. You couldn't tell because she's always smiling. If you look at her pictures, every picture, she's smiling and cheesing. When we was younger, I used to be like, Mom, how could you tell us apart? And I'm looking at the baby pictures, and she's like, well, Keisha's always smiling. You always look serious. And I'm like, oh, okay, now I can tell the difference. I couldn't even tell who I was. It's crazy. But her, she went through so much.
You guys were really close as you were growing up, huh?
We were so close. If I needed something, she had me. If she needed something, I had her. She had friends. She went through a cycle of being homeless, domestic violence, all kind of things, and overcame all that. To end up dead like this by the hands of the police to protect and serve. She went through so much, but to end up to get killed like this by the police. Was times I had to go pick her kids up just from the babysitter because she getting off of work late and she couldn't do it. And her meeting me on the bus and I'm driving to meet her to pick her up, to drop her off at home, to take care of her kids. She went all out for her kids. If anybody could tell you, her kids was her priority.
Rose, I want to give you a chance to say something about your daughter. I know it's hard, but I think if you can, it would be really important.
She's a loving child. I must say she loved, always smiling, always. And she loved her children, no matter what. I will tell her, I say, Keisha, go to Las Vegas and leave the kids with me. We'll take care of them until you settle down. And she can say, yes, mommy, I'll do it. And then the next minute I called her again, she said, I'll take them with me. And so I was like, Keisha, they will keep you back. You leave them with us for a couple of months, and then we'll send them back to you. And she was telling me again, yes, mommy. I called back again. She said, no, they're with me. I'm here already. She's just loving. She was just loving. That child was loving.
So that's what you would want people to know the most about Keisha.
Yes, loving and giving and caring. She would have other kids with her. She have her three to take care of, and she would add more to hers and take care of them too with little that she had.
Tricia, what should people know about the struggle right now to get justice for Keisha and for Mark Quinton?
People should know that Mark Quinton was a father, had custody of three kids. He had four kids, but had custody of his three daughters. And she had custody of her three sons. It was two parents out having a good time. He was a truck driver. It was just a weekend of them having fun to end up killed like that. Everybody still can't understand. I mean, these days people pull over. They tell you, if you're drunk, pull over and go to sleep. Isn't that what they tell you? Don't drink and drive. Pull over. Maybe that's what they did. How do you end up dead pulling over from being intoxicated? I see my sister that night at a baby shower. I got to dance and sip a little bit with my sister and talked with my sister. Went to work later on that night. Got home early that morning, calling her. And I'm like, this is my twin. Why she ain't answering the phone? Let me call his phone. I'm calling his phone, he not answering the phone. And he usually answers the phone. Because he came down here with his girls. His sister was watching his girls. My sister found a babysitter to watch her boys. It's not like, you know, this was some random thing and they just left. No, they made a point to see each other and have people watch their kids.
Look, this reminds me of an incident that happened a number of years ago in the 90s.
Yeah, Taisha.
Taisha Miller, yeah. Almost the same story. But the thing with Taisha is that there was no mistaking it. And it's something you can't forget about this, because this country, this system, and particularly the police who are in charge of maintaining their order, which their order means oppression, okay? And the thing is that this system murders black and brown people disproportionately. In the streets, the police murder. How many times do we have to see this?
Yeah.
Time after time after time after time.
I'm trying not to think like that. I'm trying not to think like that, but that's what it's looking like. That's where it's boiling down to, you know? I don't want hatred. I don't want none of that. Just justice. Just answers, you know?
And on that note, I want to thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Sure. All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, Raymond Latta of Revolution Newspaper, and Keisha Michaels' family, David, Rose, Gregory, and Tricia. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistants, Jeff Pryor and Alex Brenner, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. All right, we're going to go out now with just a little bit from a song that's so appropriate, System of a Lost Cause Man by Ghetto Priest.
I will never be part of their scene.